PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Larry Pinkney. Larry is a dedicated activist. He's been at it a long time. He's a former political prisoner. He's a Black Panther Party veteran. He knows the dirty system, as they say, up close and personal. I write about it all the time, but I've never lived it the way Larry has, and he can explain it a lot better than I can or anybody else who really hasn't experienced the bitter pill that so many people are fed unjustly in America alone. Right here, abroad, all across the world, that's the real American legacy. Larry, are we connected? I think we're still trying to get Larry on. I'll get cued when he comes on. Larry has a few things on his mind, and I'll let him get into them when he jumps on air. So many things are on my mind. I've written so much about what's going on in Syria. I can't say things are quiet, because they certainly are not quiet. The beast residing in Washington has backed off for the time being on shock and awe against another country. I don't think for a minute the war is off, and I've said it, and I've written it many times, that Syria is Obama's war. He began it in 2011. He didn't plan it, but he implemented it. It was planned years ago. It was planned against all independent sovereign countries. That's the only reason these countries are attacked. It's got nothing to do with their ideology. It doesn't matter if they're secular or religious. It doesn't matter if they're despotic or democratic or anything in between. It matters whether they bow to America's interests or they maintain their sovereign independence. The ones who value their independence more than being a U.S. puppet state are the ones that get targeted for regime change. We know what's going on in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria now, Iran in the target zone, Venezuela, and some other countries. And Washington takes them either one at a time or occasionally in multiples. And wars are waged directly and with proxies. Right now, the Syria war is a proxy war. Obama came within a whisker of making it a direct war. Larry, I know we're connected now. I'll just finish this thought and let you jump in. I'm very concerned that what may remain a proxy war will once again, on the basis of another false flag, a pretext, get America to get the U.S. public on board, at least not against, and maybe a little bit supportive of another war. But Americans are sick and tired of war, and they've got good reason to be. I don't know that I remember the response to Congress outside of what may have taken place in on-street protests. I think they were pretty calm, pretty slim. But the response to Congress in emails and letters and phone calls was absolutely astonishing. And yes. I quoted a number of congressional people, senators, congressmen, both parties, saying they were so flooded with anti-Syrian war messages from their constituents, 100 to 1, 300 to 1, 500 to 1. It's like they never saw such an overwhelming one-sided response. The one thing that matters most to the people in Congress is getting reelected. What else? You anger your constituents, and maybe that will be jeopardized. So with this kind of a response, they basically said, we ain't going to support this thing. And if Congress didn't want to support it and came out publicly and said so, Obama had no choice but to back off, which is what he did. But, you know, you back off and you come back and fight another day. Larry, I'm sorry to go on.
Right. I think that the Obamatron, as I call him, Mr. Drone Man, I think that he's biding his time. He does intend to it's no way he intends to not try to carry out his war plans. However, I think that you made a very, very good point. I also have been reading quite a bit of material, articles, etc., indicating that the opposition to Obama's Syria war plans was simply astounding, overwhelming, particularly as it affected members of Congress. So, yeah, I have definitely been following that. And I think you're also quite correct, Stephen, when you say that, you know, people are just fed up. They're sick and tired of it. The war, the blood, it's enough already. But now we have to be proactive and do something to make sure we don't go down that route again. You know, because we're still going down that route in Afghanistan, Pakistan. I mean, the list is endless. Somalia, Libya, blah, blah, blah. So, we still haven't really, done what needs to be done, but it's a good beginning.
Oh, there's no question this stuff goes on. Most people don't realize that that going back a number of years, and the Washington Post, of all publications, actually wrote about this a few years ago, that the U.S. Special Forces and these people are trained killers. That's what they are. They're experts in killing and demolition and all that, and all related things. They operate in over 120 countries globally. There are only 193. So they operate in roughly two-thirds, that we know of the world's countries, and they're not goodwill ambassadors, to say the least. And CIA, Larry, they're everywhere. They're like crabgrass. They are everywhere. I guess no crabgrass in the desert, at least most of the desert. But CIA operatives are literally everywhere. They're in USA. Any place America has an embassy, there are CIA operatives inside, and every country with a U.S. embassy knows it. And they're there to spy and do all kinds of other nefarious things. This is what America does, and does it on a global basis. And when you have these trained killers running around in 120 or more countries, they're there for mischief, and that's exactly what they do. So this is part of the proxy wars, and then you get the drone wars. I just wrote I wrote many articles on drones, Larry. I wrote a recent one maybe a week or so ago, and I went back and revisited some of what I'd written before, a study that I love to quote from, but also two new ones. But the one I love was a combination New York University and Stanford University study that basically said only 2% of the targets killed were what America calls high-value targets. In other words, somebody they really went after to kill, and most of the others were civilians, and that's what the drone wars are all about.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the word murder is absolutely accurate. I mean, this is murder. You know, you remember the movie or series Murder Incorporated? Well, I mean, this is murder, and when we think of the fact, as you pointed out, that you have this country has literally trained killers. What they call patriotism is not patriotism. These are trained murderers, trained killers who go around killing people. That's what they do, as you mentioned. And at least they have been let loose in at least 120 countries. That may be more. We just don't know. But at least 120 countries. And the fact is that the drones are the same thing. In term, only they take out even more. When I say take out, they kill even more people at one strike or with one strike. And it's horrible, and this is being done, and perpetrated and perpetuated, if you will, in our name, in the name of the people of this nation. And then the authorities, the government has the nerve to turn around and say to the American people, they hate us because of our freedom. No, they hate us because of the horrible things we're doing around the world. And we don't have any freedom to speak of. So that's a bunch of nonsense. But anyway, back to you, my friend.
Oh, well, again, we certainly agree on that, Larry. And I've quoted Obama so often, and I don't... It's hard to remember the exact words of everything, but I know I've quoted him with regard to drones, where he basically said, we do not kill innocent civilians. You know, if I know it, Larry, and if you know it, and if everybody listening to this program knows it, and you can just check, I mean, New York University and Stanford University, you would think they would support the empire, and they came out with a stinging report. It's in one of my articles. If anybody Googles my name, Drone Wars, New York University, Stanford University, you can find one or more of the articles I wrote on this, and you can see exactly what these two universities the institutions in these universities actually said. So if they said it, it's not like an independent media site said it. Two well-known universities said it, and they were extremely hostile to the U.S. program. And it continues, and it shows no signs of ending. I wrote an article, it was well over a year ago, that the plans are to put drones literally over all parts of America, surveillance drones. But they're the same kind of predator drones. They carry these missiles, and they can easily arm them. And if they want to, they can kill Americans the same way they're killing people in other countries. And don't bet they won't do it.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, the indication is clear because they have already done it and killed Americans in other countries. And for all we know, even in this country, but we know they have certainly targeted and killed U.S. citizens outside of the country. No trial, no jury, no judge, no nothing, just dead. So when I say that we don't really know for whether they've killed in this country, Americans in this country or not, I would draw people's attention to provision 1021 of the NDAA, which indicates that Americans can be scooped up, no trial, no judge, no jury, nothing, and held indefinitely, abused, or even killed. And it's just people need to thoroughly read 1021, that provision, because it makes it clear that, and moreover, the government does not even have to say whether they're holding your loved one or your friend or your relative or not. Don't even have to say. So I wasn't being facetious when I said, for all we know. But, you know, I just wanted to mention that.
Well, Larry, that's a topic I wrote plenty about. Literally, where the U.S. military can operate anywhere in the world, including on U.S. soil, including in sovereign countries, they can arrest anyone they want. They can arrest U.S. citizens anywhere in the world. They can literally put them in a military dungeon, as you said, Larry, uncharged, without a trial, and leave them there, dare I say, forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that literally is the policy that came out of the National Defense Authorization Act.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember quoting Senator Carl Levin saying that either he, I think representing, I forget what committee that he chaired. I guess he still chairs it. It's not foreign relations, not intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
I forget which one it is. But he chaired one of the committees. And he wanted this provision left out of NDAA a year ago. It may have been 2 years ago, this December. It was at the end of the year that NDAA passed both houses and was signed into law by Obama. I believe it was 2 years ago this December.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Authorization Act for the subsequent year. So if it came out at the end of 2011, it was for fiscal year 2012.
And this
provision targeting U.S. citizens was left out of it. And Obama, and I quoted Levin saying that Obama specifically demanded that U.S. citizens being included in this provision. He wanted U.S. citizens targeted. So when he said something that we only want to go after other citizens, not U.S. citizens, again, he's lying. And
oh, he's a liar. Yes. The media, the corporate media goes right along with they're just his propaganda arm. But Obama is probably the biggest liar thus far in any of the presidents of this country. And we've had some huge liars. But Obama is, he takes the cake, if you will. But yeah, so this is what I think people in the United States need to be very, very much aware of. And that is that we are also targets. How can we possibly think that the things that are being done in our name, which are not being done with our support, generally speaking, how could we think that ultimately those same things wouldn't be done to we ourselves? We've got to stop this.
It can happen to anybody. I mean, they know who we are, Larry. They know where we are. They can easily target us. They can do it many ways. If they want to come get us, it is pretty, pretty tough to avoid them. And Edward Snowden, I think, said it very, very clearly and plainly. You know, he's in Russia right now, and at the moment he's safe. But he's safe because he stays hidden. And even hidden, there's no way you could hide from the CIA and the spying eyes in the sky and all the U.S. intelligence. There's no way you can do it. And he was at NSA. He knows their expertise. He knows if they want to find you, they're going to be able to find you. And once they find you, they're going to track you. They're going to monitor you always. And I think he's a guy who feels that he's living on borrowed time. Every day he gets through okay and goes to bed and awakens the next morning is one more gift, but he never knows when it may end up being the last one. So even
right.
And he does his best to stay protected as best he can, to stay hidden, which means he can't have a normal life, even in Russia, which is a country which basically supports him. But they can go after him and get him, and they probably will at some day. And they can mm-hmm. go after us, and of course they've gone after many and put them away. And we want to talk about them as well, Larry. It's a good segue to get into them. Case of Lynn Stewart, the case of Herman Wallace. Let me let you jump into that.
Well, I feel such, well, thanks so much, my brother, for segueing into this. I just feel so much pain and anger, as Lynn Stewart would say, love rage, you know, love struggle, love, rage. When I think of Herman Wallace, for example, I hope the listening audience knows we're talking about the late Herman Wallace, who succumbed to cancer after having finally been released from, well over 40 years of solitary confinement after conviction was overturned. And this was in Louisiana on October 4th when Brother Herman died. He was a target, as were so many of us. The reports, when I say the reports, I want to name some, particularly the reports coming out of the United Nations, indicate that this kind of solitary is nothing short of torture. That's what it is, torture. I mean, I myself was a political prisoner for 10 years, and even I find it difficult to fathom someone doing, spending over 40 years in solitary. And this is the United States where this is happening, not some other country. So in any event, I want to, in a very small way, say that I'm deeply grateful, as I think everyday black, white, brown, red, yellow people of all colors, all walks of life are grateful to Herman's struggle. And I would urge people to get, either from your library or you can order it, get the documentary. It's about an hour long, called Herman's House. You will be quite surprised. You will be quite touched. You will be quite inspired. It's called Herman's House. Please get it. And I'll just leave it at that. Now, with respect to our sister Lynn Stewart, an incredible, I call her the people's lawyer, the woman who has stood up for well over 40 years fighting for the human rights and dignities of people really all over the world, but especially in the New York area, but known for standing strong. I mean, she wasn't a dump truck lawyer. She was real. The government despised her because she exposed some of their nasty tactics. We have our sister who's been in prison now for approximately 4 years after having been targeted and set up. And she is in, I believe it's Carswell in Texas. She is suffering from terminal, and I repeat, terminal cancer. The sister has, Glenn has, you know, at most 12 months, and it's probably much less than that, to live. We want her out. We want her out. She should have never been in prison in the first place, but it is now even more urgent that Lynn Stewart, S-T-E-W-A-R-T-L-Y-N-N-E, Lynn Stewart be released and come home to the people who love her, to the communities that love her, respect her. And she, too, targeted by both administrations, or regimes as I call them, the Bush regime and the Obama regime, who has continued this travesty and in many respects made it even worse, sort of like what he's done in Afghanistan and Pakistan, continued these things and made them worse. And he's done the same thing with respect to Lynn Stewart. But I want to share, or maybe you can do that, if you don't mind, I was going to tell folks about the Love for Lynn Stewart site that was supported and designed by the Black Activist Writers Guild. But I'll stop now, or for now, I'll stop.
Oh, it's astonishing. There have been two petitions on behalf of Lynn, global petitions, Larry, and I don't know the precise number of people who supported them. I signed both petitions, but Larry, you alerted me, and I checked Lynn Stewart's site every now and then, but I hadn't checked it when this map was posted. Anyone can Google Lynn Stewart, Lynye, Stewart, Stewart, for anyone who needs help spelling it. Sometimes even I get it wrong. Spelling was never my long suit, or math, or anything too technical. But there's a map on her website, maintained by other people, of course, and it shows the countries in the world with dots on a global map where the support comes from. It's literally from countries, dozens of countries all over the world, many tens of thousands of people supporting Lynn. And before the program began today, I sent Larry an email saying that before the Bush administration targeted her, John Ashcroft, when he was Attorney General, Lynn was a reasonably well-known New York human rights attorney. She'd been at it for many, many years, 30 years. 30 years of supporting society's most disadvantaged is the way I like to explain it. And if clients could pay, fine. If they couldn't pay, she would do pro bono work. She did it because it matters. And her husband, Ralph Pointer, another long-time human rights activist. So they were a wonderful team. Ralph, not a lawyer, I don't believe, but no. Ralph did extraordinary human rights work, and Lynn, of course, through her legal work, supporting people most often who were innocent. But she did what the government did not want done. She was the advocate, and a very effective advocate, for people prosecutors wanted convicted. They wanted them behind bars. They didn't want anyone skilled enough to be able to get innocent people off, and they finally found a way to go after Lynn. It was on a silly technicality that absolutely meant nothing, because she was a member of Ramsey Clark's legal defense team, Ramsey Clark, attorney general during the Lyndon Johnson administration, about the only attorney general this country ever had, that became an extraordinary human rights activist, and he still is. I guess he's getting well up in years now, but he's still around. He still speaks publicly. I think he still occasionally writes something. He's written a number of books. He's written, I think, a good number of articles. I've got several of his books on my shelf, and he's an extraordinary man. And he asked Lynn to join his team to help defend the man known as the Blind Sheikh. He was wrongfully convicted of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. I think many people don't remember that. It did some damage, and I can't recall if it killed anybody, probably injured some people, maybe a few deaths. It certainly didn't bring down one of the towers. But there was a bombing, and he was wrongfully blamed for it. He was convicted, sentenced to life imprisonment, and Ramsey Clark asked Lynn to join his appeals defense team. Lynn was very, very busy. I've said it on this program before, but she said, quoting her, "How do you say no to Ramsey Clark?" Pretty tough to do. So she joined his team. She did exactly the same things he did. They never laid a glove on him. They went after her. And this is where she is. Next month, Larry, I don't know the precise date. I think it's early in November. She'll reach her fourth anniversary incarcerated. It began in a New York jail, and it ended up at Carswell, Texas, what they call a medical center. Yeah, it's a medical center, like my bedroom's a medical center. I mean, they don't get anywhere close to decent health care, which is the reason Lynn is stage 4 cancer, dying. Who knows? She's got months to live. Lynn has made a statement, I could quote her again, saying she wants to die at home. She doesn't want to die in prison. She's got every right to do it. She deserves compassionate release according to U.S. Bureau of Prison Regulations. She absolutely qualifies right down the line. It should have been done a long time ago. It hasn't been. She was denied once. The request was made again. Lawyers citing everything that needed to be cited to show that she qualifies. She and anybody qualifying the way she does should be released. It should be expedited. And in Lynn's words again, things are proceeding at a snail's pace. Maybe they'll do it the way they did it with Herman Wallace, Larry. You know, they let him out, He died 3 days after they let him out.
Exactly.
Oh, we've got a break coming. I'll mention very quickly before we jump off for the break. In the article I wrote about him, I quoted him saying, if he gets out or when he gets out, he'll come out dancing. He'll come out dancing in the streets. And he mentioned something about the other prisoners waving to him in the windows. Well, Herman didn't come out dancing. He came strapped to a stretcher. Not a stretcher, but a gurney that took him to an ambulance straight to a hospital. And I saw a photo of him. I mean, he looked like a man who did not have much time to live. And the doctor said he was literally on borrowed time. He could go anytime. Within 72 hours, he was dead. Larry, we'll take a break, and we'll come right back. Welcome back, talking with Larry Pinkney. Larry, I've written a lot about the abusive U.S. Gulag prison system. I've also written a lot about America and Israel, and talking about their human rights records. I literally don't know of any other two countries more abusive of human rights and being more hypocritical about it than America and Israel. And just the issue of putting innocent people in prison and treating them so abusively, including being isolating them long term, where a man like Herman Wallace, who I believe was wrongfully accused of killing another prisoner, and I believe the issue with him, Larry, correct me if I'm wrong, was his in prison activism. He supported prisoner rights, and they went after him for that reason, and they bribed another prisoner to lie, claiming he was involved in killing a guard. I think it was a white guy, but it didn't matter. Killed a guy or killing anybody, but it happened to be a guy, and it happened to be a white guy. And this other person, I don't know who it was, got some sort of leniency in return for framing Herman and two other men, Albert King and
Albert Woodfox and Robert King.
King was never charged, and he got out about a decade ago. He was kept in prison.
Right.
For something else, and he got out about a decade ago, and Woodfox is still there.
Right,
and
right.
And he was in solitary all these years as well.
Right, right. Robert spent, in fact, I was just talking to Robert on the phone a week ago, last Saturday or Sunday. Anyway, Robert spent 29 years in solitary. They were targeted, they were called the Angola 3, meaning Angola, Louisiana, the Angola prison, and the name really came from Black Panther Party veteran, Malik Rahim. And Malik was the one who introduced Herman in particular to the philosophy and ideology, if you will, of the Black Panther Party. And so they formed, they meaning the three, Robert King, Herman Wallace, Albert Woodfox, formed a chapter. That was it, the Panther Party chapter in Angola prison. And this was prior, you know, to the setup, the frame-up of them. But you were absolutely correct when you said that they were targeted because they were fighting prison abuses that were, it's hard to even explain to the audience. I don't know if people can really understand. They talk about Bagram and other prisons and Guantanamo. We better understand we have that right here in the United States. It's horrible anywhere, but we have it right here in the United States. The three of them, Robert, Albert, and Herman, were known as activists to basically fight for the rights. And I say fight, I mean struggle for the rights of prisoners as being human beings, very basic rights. fighting against the abuses, and I mean both physical and psychological abuses. Just horrible. I just, it's sometimes very difficult for me to talk about because I don't know if people really get what I'm saying. So the next time you think about, for example, Guantanamo, just think about right here, what's going on throughout this country, throughout this nation, the horrible things that are happening, to prisoners. And it's a process of set, it's sadistic. Dehumanizing, it's meant to be dehumanizing, and then you hear drone man Barack Obama say things like he doesn't target Americans and, oh, it's freedom and justice and democracy and all of this kind of nothingness, because none of these things are true anyway that this man says or his minions. So anyway, I don't want to digress. My point is that the Angola 3, as they're known, were indeed targeted for fighting for, struggling for human rights. The nerve of them to struggle for human rights for prisoners. So I just wanted to throw that in.
Oh, and that's considered a crime in America, just the way in Israel or in occupied U.S. territory, legitimate resistance for freedom is considered terrorism, and aggressive warfare and crimes against humanity, they are called self-defense. This is the language of the empire, Israel, a mini-empire, if you could call it that, and America mm-hmm. with ambitions to be, well, it is an empire, wanting to be an even more hegemonic global empire, by getting rid of all these independent countries. And this is the real policy of these nations that are really the scourge of human rights, the scourge of independence, the scourge of everything that's right, and literally their policies indicate the most extreme wrongs I can imagine. And it's so true, Larry. Listeners certainly know what Guantanamo is and enough to know what's going on there. And even people that don't follow the alternative media, they know a little bit about Guantanamo. But what goes on in Guantanamo, it's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, mm-hmm. America has torture prisons around the world. And what goes on in U.S. prisons, in large respect, in many respects, is exactly the same thing. And mm-hmm. I can't think of anything worse than long-term isolation, where a man like Herman Wallace could be locked up there for over 40 years. I don't know how anybody could keep their sanity in 40 years.
Here's a
brief paragraph that I wrote about it that was in my article on Herman Wallace, Larry. And I said the long-term effects are extremely profound. They include severe anxiety, panic, rage, loss of control, emotional breakdown, hallucinations, profound despair and hopelessness, regressive behavior, paranoia, self-mutilation, suicidal thoughts, and other destructive behavior. Just imagine locked in a windowless cell 23 hours a day, 7 days a week, for a month, for a year, for a decade, for longer. I can't imagine anybody surviving that. And yet Herman came out of it, and if he hadn't come down with terminal cancer, he'd be alive today. Well, he may still be in prison. They probably wouldn't have let him out, Larry. But if he mm-hmm. had gotten out, maybe he would have come out dancing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is that, and I express this myself, that having been a political prisoner and having spent a considerable amount of time, about maybe a third to two-thirds in solitary. And but that was just some years. It wasn't, I was in prison for 10 years before I got my United Nations ruling, which they basically ignored, ruling that I had been wrongfully convicted in the first place and in prison. But anyway, my point is that now if I can't, I find it difficult to imagine. I can only guess what other people are thinking. But I hope that what we the people remember is that we can't allow these things to go on. We just can't, because what is done to other people is also being done to us. And even if it weren't being done to us, and it will be, but even if it weren't, it cannot be allowed to go on. And I'm going to segue into something really quickly, very quickly. There's an article I now write for Intrepid Report. I'm an associate editor with Intrepid Report. That's intrepidreport.com. There's an article it's very short. I try to keep my articles fairly short. Anyway, it's a piece called How the Corporate Media distorts and manipulates news and information. I go to Intrepid Report, check it out. I think you'll find it interesting. I give an actual example it happened about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, but I don't want to spoil the article for you. Just check it out. The article's entitled How the Corporate Media Distorts and Manipulates News and Information. It's an Intrepid Report. And you can find all of the things that I write, or virtually all, not all the things, but all my articles can be found at Black Activist Writers Guild. That's Black Activist WG, stands for Writers Guild.org. And just go there, and you will see, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of articles, et cetera, et cetera. And check out the archive, et cetera. But it's Black Activist Writers Guild. And it's BOG, by the way. We call it BOG for short, B-A-W-G, Stephen. But it's BOG who put together the Show Love for Lynn Stewart map, which I hope people will please check it out. You know, love, if you just Google Love for Lynn Stewart, that map should come up. It's very encouraging and inspiring, but we've got to fight. We know that these, you know, I the word devil doesn't even apply. They're beyond devils. They would make I think they'd make the devil blush. By they, I'm talking about this filthy, corrupt, despicable, lying, inhumane, sadistic system. And you know, we have got to stand up. We the people, black, white, brown, red, yellow people, we've got to stand up. We've got to, because at stake, I keep saying this over and over again, at stake is the survival of humankind, just everyday ordinary people, and the survival of this planet, Mother Earth. We don't have any choice. We have got to take this fight, this struggle to another level. So I'll shut up and turn it back over to you.
Oh, I don't want you to shut up, Larry. But not by any means. But we certainly absolutely agree right down the line. And I consider the corporate media what I call the scoundrel media, public enemy number one. I mean, they literally could change the entire process around if they wanted to. If they told people the truth, especially on television, where most people turn for what is called news and information today, and of course there's none there. All you get is around the clock propaganda and misinformation, junk food news, and it doesn't matter whether you're watching a CNN or CBS or Fox or public broadcasting or National Public Radio or the BBC or Al Jazeera. I mean, they're all in it for the same thing. They're there to lie to you to make you think that the opposite of what is what they tell you. But thankfully, the good news, Larry, is their ratings are going down. You see it in newspapers going bankrupt, how they say operating. I don't know how they finagle that financially, but my own Chicago Tribune went bankrupt. I haven't read the Chicago Tribune except to check them online every now and then to quote them in a media critique article. And once in a while, I get a phone call saying, we'd like to give you the Tribune free for 2 weeks or something or other. I turn them down every time. I'd be embarrassed to have it sitting outside my front door.
I know the feeling. I do know the feeling.
I would consider it toxic pollution. But whether it's the Tribune or the New York Times,
right.
It's all the same. But the news publications are having a hard time. That's why they're trying to get away from print and more doing it online, and they're charging for it. And the television ratings are going down. And my great hope is that they'll plunge so low that there literally is no longer a viable operation, and they'll have to shut down and go off air unless they simply want to do it with few or no advertisers, because advertisers need eyeballs. If they don't get the eyeballs, they're not going to spend their money for nothing. But the ratings are going down on all of them, and I suspect that the broadcasters will go first. They have one, I think they still have one newscast toward the end of the day, 5, 6 o'clock in the evening, and that's 30 minutes. I believe that's what they do. And at the beginning of television, it used to be, I think, one channel when there were only three in total having a 15-minute broadcast. John Cameron Swayze, I still remember him.
Me too. I do too. Yeah, John Cameron Swayze. Yeah.
Oh, around 1950 or so, 15 minutes every night, and my dad would turn it on. I don't remember how good or bad he was, but in 15 minutes, you really can't cover too much ground. The only one I remember who I had even a modest amount of respect for was Walter Cronkite. And I must tell you, Larry, that I once tried to get him on this program. I tried too late. I made contact with his CBS, let him keep an office at their headquarters in New York, with a secretary or maybe a small staff. Maybe that's what they do for some of their well-known people. Well, they did it for him. And I made contact with his office. I did it when he was over 90 years old. It was too late, and they were very nice to me. And they said he really decided that he passed the point where he just wants to relax and not do interviews anymore. And he had some kind of a boat, or I forget exactly what they called it, but he liked to go out sailing or whatever it was. And this is what he wanted to do. He didn't want to do interviews anymore. But it would have been a great thrill for me to get him on the program. And I had a feeling that if I ever engaged him in discussion, he would pretty much go along with a lot of the things we're saying now, Larry.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think so, too. I also remember Walter Cronkite actually even better than Swayze. In terms of my own memory, I remember eating dinner and watching him on black and white TV. I'm talking about Walter Cronkite. And I remember the scenes from Vietnam where they were showing people being mutilated. And by the way, the mutilations were being carried out by the United States government. Their heads were being blown off, et cetera, et cetera. Villages being burned. Remind you of anything like Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, Fallujah. I mean, it just, anyway, but you saw it. You were sitting at the dinner table, as it were, and you saw these things. And today, the corporate media, I call it the corporate stream media, you call it the corporate scoundrel. Is that the right word, scoundrels? Because they are scoundrels. And you're absolutely correct. They are absolute scoundrels. They do everything they can to disinform, misinform, keep people from thinking. They don't want us to be critical thinkers. They want us to be lethargic. They want us to be essentially robotrons or robots. And it's subversive not only to stand for human rights in this country. Not only is that subversive, it's subversive now to even think. To critically think. So it's time for us all to be subversive.
Well, Larry, I think I've also mentioned on this program the big difference between the Vietnam era when Cronkite was broadcasting and now. Of course, the technology now is much more sophisticated, and the big difference as far as viewers were concerned was Cronkite showed video images of the war in Vietnam. Enough of how dirty it was so people got an idea just what an ugly war that was. And it was jungle war as opposed to desert war. But the brutality and mass killing and human suffering, you really got a snapshot of what that was all about. And, of course, that changed. And Lyndon Johnson accused Walter Cronkite of losing the Vietnam War. In other words, the stories that he put on air 5 nights a week on CBS, I think probably had a lot to do to arousing the protests, the anti-war protests that went on for years. They began in the 1960s. Gulf of Tonkin, 1965, was that the year, Larry? I think it was 1965. That's
things
really revved up.
Yeah. In 65 things, you said it. They really revved up then. Yeah. And I recall myself. I was with an organization called the Black National Draft Resistance League, remembering, if our listeners remember, that at that time there was a draft where people were, there's still a draft today, it's an economic draft, but this was a blatant draft where, you know, when you turned 18, your number was going to come up. 9 times out of 10, you were going to be drafted into the U.S. Army and you expected to go fight and die, or fight and kill and then die in Vietnam. But anyway, I digress. Go ahead, Stephen.
Oh, well, the closest I ever came to that was back in college, but back then you could get a student deferment. I believe you could in the Vietnam era as well, but I can remember as a freshman, I began college in the fall of 1952. The Korean War ended I forget the month, but ended maybe around mid-1953. The armistice, not the end of the war. There's still a state of war that exists. But mm-hmm. the armistice was in 1953. But I can remember as freshmen, we used to say how important it is that we keep our grades up because we didn't want to end up in the frozen chosen. The Chosun mm-hmm. Reservoir in North Korea, that could be mm-hmm. a very, very cold place in the wintertime. So the thing that most concerned us was we certainly didn't want to do anything to jeopardize our student standing because we could end up being drafted and sent over to Korea, and none of us wanted any part of that. So I was lucky, and by the time I got out of college in 1956, that war was long over. I got through grad school. I was beyond the age of being drafted. And of course, the Vietnam situation heated up in the 1960s. And one of the, probably, I believe the greatest sin in the eyes of the empire that Jack Kennedy committed was he wanted to bring the troops home from Vietnam. At first, he sent more over, and I think he realized this was not the thing that should be done. And he mm-hmm. declared, I believe publicly, that he wanted to end that America's involvement. He wanted to bring U.S. forces home. And of all the things that he did that got people in the empire angry at him, I think that was the number one thing. And that was before November of 1963. 22nd of November, a day I'll never forget. So we're coming up on another anniversary of that date. But I believe that was the number one thing that got him killed, and it certainly wasn't by Lee Harvey Oswald. It was a CIA hit job. There's no question about that. And Sirhan didn't kill Bobby Kennedy, and James mm-hmm. Earl Ray didn't kill Martin Luther King. I mean, the story, the garbage that were fed, the lies that were fed, and the real truth is exactly the opposite. And James Earl Ray never even got a trial. Never even got a trial. Mm-hmm. When they examined the rifle that killed him, which was his rifle, the ballistics showed that the rifle, a gun that killed him, did not match James Earl Ray's gun. I remember that. Mm-hmm. The little mm-hmm. I've written about him. I've written about Kennedy's killing. I've written about Sirhan and how he was framed. It goes on and on, Larry. Mm-hmm. And the wars mm-hmm. go on.
The King family, by the way, I'm sure you're familiar with this. There was a trial which made it quite clear that James Earl Ray was not the killer of Dr. King.
I thought he did not get a trial.
No, I'm not talking about him getting a trial. I'm saying that the King family had a trial of its own, and in this trial, evidence was presented through the state. James Earl Ray was not, you're right, you're absolutely correct, he didn't. But, you know, my point being that if people would just do a little bit of research, they would find out that we have just been lied to and lied to and lied to and lied to. And that's, of course, as you said, with the technology, if anything, they just lie even more. I mean, Malcolm, I quoted Malcolm, in the beginning of my article, and he said the media is the most powerful entity on earth, that they have the power to make the innocent guilty and to make the guilty innocent. And Malcolm was correct. Of course, they did the same thing with him, agent provocateurs and U.S. government agents. As soon as Malcolm grew from being a narrow-minded cultural black nationalist into an internationalist, Malcolm had to die, and they killed him. So, I mean, these are things we need to be aware of, but we have to also remember that the emperor really has no clothes, and by that I simply mean that once you start demasking their lies, they lose the power. I like what you were describing, Stephen, about the media. I'm looking forward to the corporate media becoming so discredited, and they're discrediting themselves with their garbage. I'm looking forward to them being so discredited that they, as you say, just go right out of business.
I dream of that day. I dream of awakening one day, and there's no more CNN, and no more mm-hmm. Fox, and no more MSNBC. They just don't mm-hmm. exist anymore. That would be a wonderful day. There'll be garbage that will replace them, Larry. You'll get another movie channel or something like mm-hmm. that. More junk food stuff. And there, of course, there are hundreds of channels. I mean, I grew up before there was any television. I didn't know what television was when I grew up as a boy. And when television came around, there were only three channels, and they only began broadcasting. I don't remember what time. They certainly didn't go around the clock. Maybe Bibi and Barathe at 7 or 8 in the morning, and they signed off maybe 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and that was the extent of television. And I mean, there actually was a little good television back in those days, some live theater and stuff like that. The stuff I didn't pay as much attention to as a boy growing up. Well, I wasn't a boy. I was in high school, maybe a junior in high school. We finally got a TV set. But now I've got all these hundreds of channels, not because I want them, but because I live in a building that has a cable subscription, however they do it, and I get what everybody else gets, unless you want to buy premium services or something like that. So I've got all this stuff, and I don't even turn it on except when I get into bed, Larry, just to turn on a silly movie to get sleepy for 15 to 20 minutes, then turn it off and go to bed. This is what television does for me. Instead of a warm glass of milk, it's some kind of a silly movie that's not too violent. So I can roll over and sleep. But they certainly don't do the job they should do. And thankfully, the alternative media is coming around and replacing them. I think we're just about out of time, Larry. A quick final comment.
I just want to thank you. I want to thank Progressive Radio Network. I want to thank first and foremost, frankly, the listening audience. Thank you all. I want you all to stay strong. You know I love you, Stephen. Remember, you can read my writings at the Black Activist Writers Guild, that's blackactivistwd.org, and at Intrepid Report, that's intrepidreport.com. So thank you so much, my brother. Stay strong.
Thank you, Larry. If this world had more Larry Pinkneys and fewer Barack Obamas, just imagine, you could actually be living in paradise. Larry, again, my great thanks to you. I'd like to sign off by reminding listeners I'm on every Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.